Deciding to call it a night, Anya and Bernard gathered all the notes and photographs they'd produced during the day and transferred them to Bernard's office down the hall. Then they locked the lab behind them.
Tomorrow morning, then?
Sounds good. And give some more thought to getting me in to see the abbot, will you?
Your persistence is what makes you such a good archaeologist. But yes, I will. You have my word.
Satisfied, Anya rode the elevator up to the ground floor. The museum had closed for the day, and the halls were empty and silent around her. She paused for a moment at the entrance to a hall devoted to Egyptian artifacts, breathing in all the history that surrounded her, and was struck with the odd sense of being at home.
Yeah. And if you don't get out and have a life one of these days, you'll end up a stuffed mummy just like those in there.
She'd been working straight through since leaving the dojo earlier that morning, and only had a few more nights left to enjoy Paris, so it was time to get out and see the sights. No sooner had she decided to take a break, however, than she found her thoughts returning to the whereabouts of the missing bullet.
The gunshot wound almost certainly killed Captain Parker, and it should have been there with his remains. You've spent all day on this. What's another hour or so?
The spent bullet was probably lying on the floor of the chamber near the wall against which Parker's skeleton had been resting. It shouldn't be all that hard to find.
Go on, take a quick look. If you find it, great. And if not, at least you'll know you gave it a shot.
Decision made, Anya caught a cab over to the metro station they'd used to gain access to the catacombs earlier that day. The trains were still being routed around the station due to the construction, and so she was alone as she descended the steps. A uniformed police officer was waiting for her at the turnstiles, alerted to her presence by her footsteps. Obviously bored with the duty he'd been assigned, he didn't even look up as she approached.
Station's closed.
He only looked up at her when she thrust the pass under his nose that she'd been given by Laroche.
You'd be wanting to go into the tunnels then?
Yes, I shouldn't be long.
But it's after dark.
Yes, it is.
The policeman gave her a look that clearly said he thought she had a few screws loose upstairs, but he didn't say anything as he unlatched the gate and let her in. After getting a flashlight and making her way back along the circuitous route through the tunnels, Anya found herself back in the antechamber where they had found Parker's remains. She moved over to the spot where the skeleton had been found. She got down on her hands and knees and rested the flashlight on the floor so that its beam filtered across the area she intended to search. She began hunting for the missing bullet. When she'd gone over the entire area in one direction, she went back again in the other, crisscrossing her initial efforts so she could be assured that she hadn't missed a spot. When that failed to turn up what she was looking for, she moved her attention over to the wall against which Captain Parker's remains had rested. Perhaps the shot that had killed him had actually passed through his body completely, even though they hadn't found evidence of an exit wound. Perhaps the bullet had embedded itself in the wall instead of falling to the floor when the body decayed. Searching the wall, however, proved to be much harder than the floor. Comprised as it was of hundreds of human skulls, there were too many nooks and crannies and shadowed surfaces that could be hiding the impact point of the bullet. With just the beam of her flashlight to illuminate the wall's surface, there was no way she was going to find something that small amid all the stacked human bones.
I'd do better to come back in the daytime with a team of grad students and a full bank of lights. Might as well call it quits for the night.
The beam of her flashlight swept across the floor as she turned away, and out of the corner of her eye, she caught the glint of something reflecting back at her. She turned in that direction and carefully made her way forward, shining the beam of her flashlight ahead of her, searching for whatever it was. When she reached the wall, she slowly spun in a circle, still searching, knowing that whatever it was had to be here somewhere.
It couldn't just get up and walk out on its own. There!
It was a heavy gold signet ring set with a dark-colored stone. It was lying on the floor near the wall directly across from where they had found Parker's remains, and it was partially obscured by the collapse of several loose bones, which explained why she and the rest of Bernard's team had missed it. She kept the flashlight beam trained on it as she walked over, not wanting to lose sight of it, and then bent to pick it up. She turned as she straightened up, ring in hand, and she caught sight of the dark form standing behind her. Anya was flung backward against the carefully piled bones lining the wall behind her. The whole mess came tumbling down around her in a hard rain, bones bouncing off her head and shoulders. She struggled to extricate herself from the jumbled pile. Her attacker was moving toward her. Her right hand folded around the hilt of a sword that hadn't been there seconds before as she willed it into existence from the otherwhere. She swung out with the sword and felt it slice through the flesh of the man's arm.
Oh, oh.
Blood splashed across her face, and whoever it was drew back. Anya scrambled to her feet. Her attacker turned and ran. Anya took off after him. He only had a few seconds head start, and so she would have been able to catch up to him quickly, but the lack of a light source quickly had her steps faltering and slowing to a stop after only a few dozen yards. Getting lost in the dark was not something she wanted to experience, no matter how badly she wanted to know who it was that had followed her down here or why they'd attacked. She took a moment to catch her breath and gather her thoughts. She realized, with no little surprise, that her left hand was still clenched tightly around the ring that she'd picked up off the floor.
Thank goodness for small favors.
Not wanting to lose it after all this, she slipped it into her pocket to look at later. With her hand against the wall to use as a guide, she made her way carefully back down the tunnel until she could see the thin beam of light from her flashlight spilling out of the entrance of the antechamber. She stepped into the room, retrieved her flashlight, and decided that she'd had enough excitement for one day. Sword still in hand, she cautiously retraced her steps back up to the subway tunnel and from there to the station itself. She kept on the lookout for any sign of her attacker, but didn't see or hear anyone along the way. Before entering the station, she released her sword back into the otherwhere. For coming out of a dark tunnel carrying a sword in hand didn't seem like the safest way to reacquaint herself with the police officer on duty. As it turned out, she needn't have worried. The guard was nowhere in sight.
That's not a good sign.
He wouldn't have left on his own without being relieved. At least, she couldn't imagine him doing that, knowing full well that she was in the tunnels. That meant that something had happened to him.
He probably ran into the same bastard that I did.
If that was the case, he could be lying somewhere unconscious, perhaps even seriously injured. She couldn't leave without looking for him. It didn't take very long. She found the police officer lying against the far side of the ticket booth, a thick trickle of blood leaking from the swollen lump on the side of his head. His breathing was steady enough, she was relieved to discover. Anya used his radio to make a call to headquarters.
I want to report an officer down at the metro station where the catacombs were discovered. He's alive, but unconscious.
And you are...
It wasn't the most Good Samaritan-like thing to do, but all she wanted was to return to her hotel and take a hot bath to ease the aches and pains out of her muscles. She wouldn't get that if she had to spend the next 3 hours downtown answering questions. Back at her hotel, she took the ring from the pocket of her jeans, cleaned it off, and held it up to the light for a good look. It was a man's signet ring, just as she'd thought. The stone set in its face was a deep crimson color that seemed to absorb the light rather than reflect it. It had been gently cut, with a beveled face and 8 short sides. The gold itself was unadorned. She suspected it was Parker's, but it could also have belonged to whomever he had been meeting there. There was no way of telling at this point. She slipped the ring into a little glassine envelope and tucked it inside one of the zippered pockets of her backpack. Then, Anya treated herself to a well-needed hot bath before hopping into bed. Given the type of activity that went on at the Museum of Natural History on a daily basis, as well as the priceless nature of some of the artifacts that were cleaned and restored within its walls, the lab there had a highly sophisticated alarm system designed to prevent unauthorized entrance to the facility. The alarm was the pride of the museum's director, for he had spent nearly 2 years on the research and testing that went into selecting the product they had finally decided to install. It was, the manufacturer said, the best of the best, and perfect for protecting a facility such as this. The three men who entered the lab at 2:30 that morning went through it like butter. The fact that they had the 16-digit code that was needed to render the alarm system inoperable made things a bit easier. Once inside the lab, one of the men moved to the drawer containing Captain Parker's remains. He opened the canvas duffel bag he was carrying and started placing the captain's remains into the sack. As he was doing so, his two companions were carefully scouring the lab for any trace that the long-missing Confederate soldier's remains had ever graced the building with its presence. Papers, thumb drives, video cards. If it could possibly contain any information about the discovery of the dead man's remains, it was picked up and dropped into a sack identical to the first. Within 10 minutes, the three men had searched the entire lab and removed everything that might possibly contain any information relative to the discovery of Captain Parker's body. When they were finished, the leader gave a quick nod to the other two, and what had once been a carefully organized search and retrieval mission turned into a free-for-all as they set about ruthlessly destroying everything they could get their hands on. Computer monitors were thrown to the floor and then stomped underfoot. Desks were overturned, and the contents of their drawers scattered throughout the room. High-tech spectrometry equipment, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars, was covered with foam from the wall-mounted fire extinguishers and then smashed with what was left of the desk chairs. It wasn't long before the room was practically unrecognizable. Finally, their job complete, the three men left the same way they came in, with no one the wiser. When Anya arrived at the museum early the next morning, she was met with a scene of confusion. Several law enforcement vehicles were parked outside the entrance when she entered. She tried to use the temporary pass Bernard had given her to gain access.
Pardon, madame, but you will have to wait.
It's okay. I'm expected.
I'm afraid that we have a situation on our hands, and I have been instructed to tell all unnecessary personnel that they are to wait in the lobby.
Wait for what, exactly?
Wait for someone to come get you.
Can you at least call down and let Dr. Reinhardt know I'm here waiting?
No. Sorry.
Yeah, I'll just bet you are.
It seemed that something was terribly wrong. If the officer wouldn't call down to the lab, she'd just have to do it herself. She pulled out her cell phone and called Bernard's office.
Vous avez atteint la boîte vocale de Bernard Reinhardt.
Come on, Bernard.
Vous avez atteint.
Anya was trying to figure out what to do next when she caught sight of Commissaire Laroche crossing the lobby behind the police line.
Commissaire! Henri!
He turned at the sound of his first name, recognized her, and made his way across the room.
Ah, and what can I do for you, Miss Creed?
I'm sure you have your hands full with whatever this all is, but I'm due to continue work on the Metro skeleton with Bernard, and the officer on duty won't let me pass the police tape.
You haven't heard, have you?
Bernard? Is he...
Professor Reinhardt is fine, Miss Creed. My apologies, I didn't mean to alarm you.
Well, if it's not Bernard, then what... It's Captain Parker, isn't it?
Captain Parker?
The skeleton from the Metro.
You've identified the body already?
It seemed more respectful than referring to him as the skeleton all the time. I think we're getting closer, though, and I can show you what we've done so far if you'd like.
I see. That's too bad. You had my hopes up for a moment there. You see, proving your theory is going to be much more difficult now, as the museum was burglarized during the night, and the thieves made off with the skeleton. Professor Reinhardt's office was ransacked as well.
Our notes and photographs?
Gone as well, I'm afraid. Do you have
any... At least they still had the Davis letter in their possession. Bernard had insisted on locking it away in the museum's vault for safekeeping the minute he'd recognized the letter's potential value. Laroche was looking at her expectantly, making her realize that she must have missed his question while thinking about the letter.
I'm sorry, what was that again?
I asked if you had any idea why the thieves would be interested only in our Confederate friend's remains.
That's all they took?
They were only interested in the skeleton and the documentation pertaining to it that you and Professor Reinhardt assembled. Nothing else was taken, including items of considerable value that were in plain view in Dr. Reinhardt's office.
No, I really don't have any idea why they just took those items.
Very well, Miss Creed.
since she was an integral part of the team that had been responsible for the skeleton's retrieval and examination, he let those on duty know that she was free to come and go as she needed. He then escorted her through the police barrier and over to the elevator leading to the lower floors, where Bernard's laboratory was located.
If you think of anything that might be helpful, please give me a call.
Yes, I will.
The scene was no less erratic on the lower floor than the one above. Police officers stood in small groups of twos and threes, while crime scene technicians moved through the various rooms, carrying out their usual duties. She spotted Bernard standing off to one side with a pained look on his face. He must have felt her attention on him, for he looked up, caught her gaze, and then nodded his head in the direction of a nearby staff room where they could get away from the scrutiny of the others in the hall.
Is it true that they got everything?
I'm afraid so.
At least we still have the Davis letter.
Well.
You did put the letter in the vault, right?
I was going to do so, but it was late, and I thought the safe in my office would be adequate for one night. I took the liberty of calling Abbot Deschanel late last night.
And?
He's agreed to see you. Apparently, a mention of Captain Parker piqued his curiosity.
Well, at least there's that.
This has become very serious business, Sonya. It's obvious that someone out there knows more about what's going on than we do. If they went to the trouble of breaking into the museum to disrupt our investigation, there's no telling what they're willing to do.
Don't worry, Bernard. I assure you I'll be careful.
Abbot Deschanel expects you later this afternoon.
Bernard handed over some handwritten directions outlining the route to the monastery and a set of car keys.
You can use one of the vehicles from the museum motor pool as well. I had it arranged when I came in this morning before I discovered this mess.
We've still got a chance to break this wide open, Bernard. The monastery holds the answer to all this. I know it does.
With a 4-hour drive ahead of her, Anya didn't waste any more time. She said her goodbyes to Bernard, thanked him again for the directions and the vehicle, and then got out of there before the police decided that they wanted to question her. It was a beautiful day for driving. The sun was shining in a bright blue sky, and for a time, Anya forgot about the morning's events and simply enjoyed the scenery. The farther she got from Paris, the more the landscape changed. The rolling green hills gradually gave way to the foothills of the mountains, and by the time she reached the final hour of her drive, she was winding her way through narrow mountain passes and verdant pine valleys. As she neared her destination, her thoughts turned to the meeting ahead of her. She decided that the best plan of action was to simply lay it all out there for the abbot, letting him know what had happened so far. He deserved to know if the people under his care were in danger, and she had no intention of keeping that information from him. She glanced out the window, taking in a nearby river as she drove on past. And then, as she came around a bend in the road, she got a glimpse of the monastery for the first time. It sat on the edge of a high promontory, like a castle guarding the mountain approach. In fact, it looked sort of like a castle, fashioned of stone that shone in the bright sunshine, with high crenellated towers and several balconies that jutted out from the protective walls. More twists and turns in the road kept the monastery from view until about 15 minutes later, when she found the way forward blocked by a locked set of wrought iron gates. They were twice her height and barred entrance to the property. A small bell hung off to one side, and with no better idea of how to get the attention of those she had come to see, she drove up next to the bell, grasped the rope, and gave it a solid yank. Several minutes had passed when the front door of a small shack on the other side of the gates, that she hadn't noticed before, opened, and a man dressed in the brown robes and sandals of a Benedictine monk stepped out. He came down the walk and stood on the other side of the gate from her, a questioning expression on his face.
I have an appointment to see the abbot.
The monk raised his eyebrows and then mimed seeing some ID, still without saying anything. The monk was under a vow of silence, she realized. Anya dug her driver's license out of her backpack. She got out of the car so she could hand it over to him. He glanced at it, compared the picture on it to her face, and then triggered a switch that opened the gates electronically. He handed her a photocopy of a hand-drawn map to follow. She drove through the gates and continued onward through the trees for a few hundred yards until she emerged into an open space, a parking area roped off on her right with the bulk of the monastery rising up on her left. She parked the car and got out, surveying the massive structure in front of her. She'd expected something small, innocuous, not this sprawling behemoth of a monastery that seemed to occupy every square inch of the promontory on which it was built. Some kind of warning must have passed from the guard shack to the monastery itself, for another brown-robed monk was waiting for her on the front steps. He watched her without saying anything as she approached along the walk. It was only when she actually reached the top of the steps that he let a smile settle on his face and stepped forward.
Good morning, Miss Creed. I'm Brother Samuel.
Pleased to meet you.
The abbot has asked me to escort you to his office in the chapter house.
He turned and entered the complex, Anya at his heels. Just inside the front door was a long central hall with offices on either side. They passed through a set of double doors at the end of the hall. They were outside once more in the cloister, a large square area of ground open to the sky and surrounded by covered walkways on each side, split repeatedly by arched openings known as arcades. The soaring heights of the cathedral rose up over the walkway directly opposite them, and Anya was struck with the desire to wander through the interior and see what the centuries-old church looked like. Brother Samuel, however, turned right, and Anya had to hurry along to catch up with him. He noticed her interest in the church and began pointing out some of the details around her.
This part of the claustral complex contains several of the most highly trafficked areas. The cathedral, the administrative offices, the chapter house, and of course the living quarters.
They came to the end of the walkways, and he pointed out across the grounds to another set of buildings.
Over there we have the kitchens, the storehouses, the infirmary, and the guest quarters.
He turned left this time, so that they were headed toward the cathedral once more. But they had gone only a few yards before they found themselves standing at a plain, unadorned door. The monk led her inside. The room Anya entered was a simple office that contained only a desk, two chairs, and a kneeler for prayer. A cross hung on the wall over the head of the wizened old man seated at the desk. Smiling, he rose.
Good afternoon, Miss Creed. I'm Abbot Deschanel. It's a pleasure to make your acquaintance.
Thank you. And thank you for seeing me on such short notice.
Happy to help. Tell me, how is Professor Reinhardt?
As impetuous as ever.
Delighted to hear it. Please, have a seat. So, how can I help you?
Well, it's a bit of a complicated story, actually.
Anya laid it all out for him, including how she'd been confronted in the tunnels and how the remains had been stolen from the museum the night before.
Sewn into Captain Parker's shirt was a small scrap of paper. Written on it was the name of this place, Berceau de Solitude. And so I thought, maybe. I mean, it's been a long time, more than 100 years, I know, but still, I thought, maybe you'd have some record of him coming here.
Well, that's quite a story. Quite a story. But I'm not sure I understand. We are just a poor community of brother monks. Why would a man like that have come here, of all places?
I honestly don't know. I was hoping you could tell me.
If I had such information, and I'm not saying I do, I'm just speaking hypothetically at this point, what would you do with it?
I had the body of a man I believe to be Captain Parker back in the laboratory at the museum. He was the victim of a gunshot wound. His remains, previously lost in the depths of the Paris catacombs until their discovery yesterday. And yet a man claiming to be the very same Captain Parker survived the war, held public office, and eventually died peacefully in his sleep at the age of 70. Clearly, one of them was not who he claimed to be. I'd like to solve that mystery.
You are right, Miss Creed. Captain Parker did indeed come here. The abbot at the time, Brother Markham, was actually a distant cousin on his mother's side, you see. According to Brother Markham's account, Captain Parker was agitated, perhaps even fearful for his life, and he gave my predecessor specific instructions to watch over a piece of his property until someone came to retrieve it in his name. There is no indication in Brother Markham's account as to the specific nature of Parker's mission or the source of his fear, just that he was clearly afraid, and that he felt it likely that he might not be back to retrieve the object himself. But I don't know any more than that, and unfortunately, Brother Markham is no longer around for us to ask him ourselves.
Do you have any idea what the object was that Captain Parker placed into the Abbot's safekeeping?
It was a wooden box, about the size of a microwave.
Do you, by chance, still have the box?
Oh, I do. And because you have come asking for Captain Parker's legacy in his name, you've allowed us to fulfill our vow to him. This is a blessed day, indeed. I'll be just a moment.
It took less than 10 minutes. When Deschanel came back through the door, he was carrying a small chest. It was about the size of an old-fashioned bread box and was covered with a thick patina of dirt and dust, as if it had been stored in the back of a closet for some time. He set it down on top of his desk and gestured for her to open it. With hands that only slightly trembled, Anya opened the chest. Inside was a small lacquered box the size of a jewelry case. She recognized it immediately. It was a Japanese puzzle box.
May I?
Be my guest.
Reaching inside, she drew out the puzzle box and set it down next to the crate. As she did so, the slip of paper that had been stuck to the bottom of the box came loose and drifted to the floor. Picking it up, Anya saw that it was a short note in an unfamiliar hand.
Sykes, time is of the essence, so I must be brief. The, Fots want...
Pardon me, the what?
Fots. It's a capital F followed by O-T and a capital S. I don't know what it is. Do you have any idea what it means?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
The Fots want more than Davis is willing to grant, and the negotiations have turned ugly. I fear for my life. This box contains everything you need to locate the species stolen from the wagon train. I trust you will see that it reaches the right hands if I do not return. Faithfully, Will.
Thanks to her research earlier that morning, Anya knew that Parker's second-in-command had been a man named Jonathan Sykes, so there seemed little doubt now that the remains did indeed belong to the Confederate captain, as she'd suspected. It was the contents of the rest of the note that really caught her attention, however. Specie, she knew, was a term used to describe money in the form of coins, usually gold or silver, that provided the backing for paper money issued by the government. Parker had to be referring to the money from the treasury. The wagon train he'd driven out of Danville had been ambushed by brigands. His official report had listed the gold as stolen. If the note was to be believed, then Parker clearly knew exactly where the treasure was, and a historic mystery was about to be solved. All she had to do was open the puzzle box. She picked up the box and examined it carefully. It was made of a highly polished hardwood, linden or perhaps cherry, and was lacquered to a fine finish. A mosaic of different colored squares covered the top, but the sides were free of decoration of any kind. Nor did it show even the slightest hint of any seams. She glanced up at the abbot, who was watching her curiously.
It's a puzzle box. In order to open it, you have to follow a certain sequence of motions.
And how do you know that you are on the right path?
You don't.
Ah, so the box mirrors life, no?
I suppose it does, but that doesn't help tell me how to get it open.
Parker hadn't left any instructions telling Sykes how to open the box, so she knew that the key had to be something they both would have understood. Anya looked at the layout of the colored tiles on the lid again. The checkerboard was 14 squares wide by 8 squares high. The 5th and 10th vertical row were slightly darker than the others, subtly dividing the mosaic into 3 even sections, 4 squares across by 8 squares deep. 3 even sections. Reaching out with one finger, Anya pressed firmly on the squares in the first section and traced the letter C.
Did you hear that?
Yes. I must be on the right track.
She did the same thing in the center section, but this time traced an S rather than a C. Grinning now, Anya moved her hand to the final section and traced the letter A. CSA, the Confederate States of America. The square in the exact center of the mosaic slid aside, revealing a depression beneath. It was just large enough to fit the average person's finger. Intrigued now, the abbot reached out a hand, intending to press the location, but Anya pulled the box out of his reach.
Wait. It could be booby-trapped.
Anya snagged a pencil off the abbot's desk and used the eraser end to poke the center of the depression. Nothing happened. She tried again. Still nothing.
Perhaps the pencil isn't wide enough.
Anya tried a third time, but with two pencils held together rather than one. The box just sat there, silently gloating at them. She bent over closer to the table and stared at the depression in the lid. From that angle, it was clear that rather than being smooth, as she'd originally suspected, it was beveled in a simple pattern. It looked familiar somehow.
Yes!
Getting up from the table, Anya went over to her backpack and dug in the pocket for the envelope containing the ring she'd found during her sojourn into the catacombs the night before. Parker's ring. Taking it out of the glassine envelope she'd stored it in, Anya held the ring up to the light and examined the stone. It appeared to have the same basic shape as the depression in the box, and it was the right size, too. She stepped up to the table and without hesitation pressed the stone atop the ring into the depression in the lid of the puzzle box. Panels across the surface of the box popped open, twisted, and turned with the help of mechanical gears buried deep inside the contraption, and these in turn opened others. It took a good 3 minutes for the box to stop rearranging itself on the table in front of them, and by the time it was finished, Anya could see a definite crease where the top separated from the rest. When she was reasonably confident that the box wasn't going to start rearranging itself again, she reached out and separated the two pieces. Inside, in a velvet-lined chamber, another envelope rested, much like the one she'd taken from the pocket of Parker's sack coat. Just to be safe, she poked that with a pencil as well before reaching in and picking it up. Inside was a single sheet of stationery.
In the cellars of the wine god lies a key without a lock that will lead you to the place where the two mouths meet. There you'll find the lady, left alone and in distress. You must secure her when you're able and take Yule's rifle from her crest. Take the rifle to the place of Lee's greatest failure, where the peacock freely roamed. Find the spot where my doppelganger rests eternal, deep beneath the loam. Disturb him in his slumber, wake him from his rest, to find that which you are seeking. Use the key to unlock the chest.
Not what you were expecting?
No, not quite. I'd been hoping for the answer, but this is just another piece of the puzzle.
But one more than you had before, no?
Yes, you're right. And I'd do well to remember it. Well, thank you for your time, Abbott. Would it be all right if I keep the letter?
Please, take the box as well. It is yours now. My duty as caretaker has been fulfilled.
They put the puzzle box back inside the chest it had been stored in and wiped down the chest with a towel the abbot fetched from another room. Once she could carry it without getting her clothes covered with dust, she shook hands with the abbot, picked up the box, and followed the monk he'd summoned to lead her back to the front door. As she got in her car, Anya was full of excitement over what she'd learned. With the information she now had, she could conclude that Parker had been in Paris to carry out some kind of secret negotiation on behalf of President Davis. Not only that, but she could also make a pretty good case that the money from the Confederate treasury hadn't been stolen by brigands at all, but had actually been rerouted by Parker himself to assist with the mission assigned to him. She was so distracted by thoughts of the future that she nearly ran into a group of six monks walking behind her car as she backed out of the parking space. Thankfully, they were paying more attention than she was and were able to skip out of the way quickly enough. Embarrassed, she gave a little wave of apology, drove back to the gate, and headed down the mountain. She'd been driving for about 10 minutes when something started nagging at her. Something about the monks she'd nearly run over. The scene unfurled before her again on the movie screen of her mind. The monk skipping back away from her car as she got too close. The hem of his dark brown robe riding up over his feet, revealing the pair of dark black boots he wore beneath. All of the monks she'd seen inside the monastery had been wearing hand-woven sandals. She slammed on the brakes, skidding to a stop. As soon as the car had stopped moving forward, she spun the wheel, stomped on the gas pedal, and took off back in the direction she'd just come from. A terrible feeling unfurled in her gut, a sense that some invisible line had been crossed, and that she was already too late to stop whatever it was from happening. She quickly found herself urging the car to go faster as she raced up the mountain road at dangerous speeds. Anya rounded the final curve, and the sprawling towers of the monastery came into view, the brick blooming in the sunshine. For a moment, she thought she'd been mistaken, that her concerns had all been for nothing. But then she saw the smoke billowing out of one of the upper-story windows and knew that she'd been horribly, terribly right. She drove through the still-open gates, skidding to a stop in the middle of the circular drive. She was up and out of the car before the engine had even stopped idling. As she rushed up the steps, she willed her sword into existence. Its familiar weight was a reassuring presence as her hand closed around its hilt. One glance was all it took to know that the man in front of her was dead. The bullet hole in his forehead stood out starkly against his pale flesh, but did little to hide his features, and it was easy for her to recognize him as Brother Samuel.
Someone is going to pay for this.
She slipped inside the door and stood in the hallway Samuel had led her through a short time earlier. The office doors on either side of the hall were standing open, but as she made her way down its length, cautiously glancing inside each room as she passed, she found that all the rooms were empty. The door at the far end of the corridor was closed, but not latched, so she used the fingers of one hand to ease it open slightly. From where she stood, Anya could see part of the cloister and a stretch of the covered walkway that ran perpendicular to her position. The body of another monk lay sprawled across the stone pavement, a dark stain spreading beneath him. The gunshot was very close, just beyond the door, in fact, in the section of the cloister she couldn't see yet. She gave a push with her hand and sent the door gliding open on well-oiled hinges, revealing the scene in the open space of the cloister just beyond. A monk in the now familiar brown robe and sandals was dragging himself on his stomach across the green grass, leaving a trail of bright red blood in his wake from the bullet wound in his leg. Behind him stalked another, similarly dressed individual, but this one was wearing combat boots instead of sandals and carried a 9mm automatic pistol in his hand. Even as Anya watched, the second man sighted along the length of his arm and shot the wounded monk in the other leg. Immediately, Anya sprinted from the doorway, leaped through the nearest arcade, and charged the gunman. The gunman twisted around, the muzzle of his gun coming up. With a swing of her sword, Anya slashed his arm just below the elbow, his gun flying free as his arm hung uselessly. Anya used her momentum to spin around. Her second strike caught the intruder at the collarbone and drove diagonally down through his neck. He was dead before he hit the ground. Unfortunately, so too was his victim. As Anya knelt down to help the injured monk, she found him staring up at her with unseeing eyes. The second bullet must have found the femoral artery, for there was a rapidly expanding pool of blood in the grass around his legs that hadn't been there moments before. Anya turned to see several men emerge from the door to the chapter house on the far side of the cloister, dragging the abbot between them. To her dismay, one of them looked up and saw her crouched there over the body.
Hey!
A glance at the entrance to the church a few feet away showed the massive oak doors propped open with what looked to be stacks of hymnals. Anya slipped inside, saying a silent thank you to whatever enterprising monk had decided a little fresh air might do the old worship center some good. She stood still for a moment, letting her eyes adjust to the dimness and trying to get her bearings. The cathedral, she knew, was shaped like a cross lying on its side. The main section of the church ran east to west, and the door she'd entered through put her halfway along the length of the nave. The presbytery, containing the altar, as well as the north and south transepts that formed the crossbeam of the cross, were to her right, She had no doubt the gunman would follow her, so she quickly ran across the center aisle of the church and hid among the pews of the north transept. From there, she could keep an eye on the door and still have room to maneuver if need be. She released her sword into the otherwear, not wanting to have to worry about it sticking up and giving her away. Anya had just knelt behind the corner of a pew when three men entered the cathedral through the same doors she had used, guns in hand. The leader glanced around, then sent each of his men along the outer edge of the church, while he advanced down the center aisle. Since the intruders were still dressed in the brown habits they had used to infiltrate the complex, she couldn't tell anything about them.
So they proceed to reform the l'église.
Anya turned and scurried down the length of the row, staying in a crouch to keep her head from showing above the backs of the pews. Her intent was to sneak around behind the advancing gunman and use the opportunity to slip back out the door she'd entered. She reached the end of the row and stuck her head around the corner, only to discover one of the gunmen coming from the opposite direction, intent on sneaking up on her in a similar fashion. Anya swept her hand out to the side, pinning her opponent's gun hand against the back of the pew. At the same time, she thrust her other hand forward, summoning her sword in the process, intent on running her opponent through. At the last second, he twisted to the side. He reflexively pulled the trigger as the sword thrust pierced his abdominal area. Her quick look had shown her several dark forms making their way down either side of the nave in an effort to box her in. She scrambled over the unconscious body of her opponent and then crab-walked down the length of the pew to the other end. From there, she looked out over the presbytery, hunting for a way out. She had a good view of the altar as well as the rest of the presbytery space behind it. Chapels lined the rounded rear wall, small alcoves with a statue of some saint or another, and a kneeler. Between the sixth and seventh chapels, roughly straight back from the altar as seen from the front of the church, was a door. It was deftly designed, the undecorated surface of the door blending in with the rest of the dark wood that made up the rear wall. And if the light hadn't reflected off the narrow metal of the sunken handle, she might never have seen it. Anya lunged to her feet and ran. She made it up the platform and halfway to the altar.
Elle est là! Obtenir son!
She flung herself behind the thick protection of the rectangular marble altar in the center of the platform. She scrambled on hands and knees over to the door and pulled it open, revealing a set of spiral steps leading upward.
Must be the choir loft.
As she paused, bullets slammed into the door beside her. Anya dashed up the stairs. What she hadn't known was that the loft was accessible from the opposite end of the church through the use of two wide walkways and a staircase in the front of the church. As she came up level with the choir loft, several shots ricocheted off the staircase around her, fired by the gunman running down the walkways in her direction. With nowhere else to go, Anya continued up the winding staircase, hoping against hope that somewhere above her was a way out. She emerged into the cupola of the bell tower, an octagonal-shaped room with large arches open to the elements on each side. She stepped out onto the roof. Ahead of her, several other intruders were climbing onto it from the access ladders on the other wing of the church. Anya realized she was about to find herself trapped between two groups of gunmen. A glance in the other direction showed her the edge of the rooftop only a few yards away, overlooking a long drop to the thundering river below. She had only seconds to make up her mind. Anya raced toward the edge of the rooftop. Arms and legs pinwheeled for a moment, then she tucked her chin against her chest and hoped for the best. After a bone-jarring impact, she plunged swiftly toward the bottom. Thankfully, the river was deep, and she felt herself slowing down before she struck the bottom. Now she felt the tug of the current trying to pull her along in its wake. She began clawing her way toward the surface, driving herself upward with powerful kicks of her long legs. But for every foot she rose upward, the river carried her 2 feet sideways, and it wasn't long before she began to feel herself tiring. Her lungs protested, but she clamped her mouth shut and fought for the surface as hard as she could. Looking around, Anya discovered that she was being swept downstream even faster than she'd thought. She was already quite far from where she'd entered the water, and even as she looked back the way she had come, she was carried around a bend in the river, and the monastery was lost from view. Perhaps even more disconcerting, however, was her realization that the water itself was shockingly cold.
If I don't do something, I'm either going to freeze to death or get swept all the way to the English Channel.
The right bank was closer. With grim determination, she turned toward it and began swimming perpendicular to the current, trying to make her way across. Bit by bit, the shore drew closer, until at last she felt the river bottom beneath the soles of her shoes. After another 10 minutes of grueling effort, she broke free of the current and emerged into shallower depths at the river's edge. She dragged herself out of the water and up onto the shore, rolling onto her back and doing what she could to catch her breath after the ordeal she'd just been through. She didn't lay there long, though, for once out of the water, the coolness of the mountain air cut through her wet clothes like an Arctic wind.
I've got to get moving.
She climbed to her feet. She could see the road through the trees about a dozen yards away. The chances of a random motorist headed in the direction she was going were pretty slim, which meant she was going to have to make her way back up the mountain to the monastery on foot. At least there she could find some dry clothes, check to see if there were any survivors, and even call for help if no one had done so already. All she had to do was walk a couple of miles uphill. Anya's pace was as fast as she could manage, but she wished she could make even better time, since there were people at the facility above who needed her help. Step by step, she made her way up to the monastery gates as quickly as she could. The gates stood wide open, which wasn't a good sign. As she walked through them, she caught sight of a brown-robed figure lying unmoving in the grass between the gates and the small guardhouse nearby. The dark stain that covered the front of his robe didn't bode well for his chances, but she had to check to be sure before moving on. As she drew close enough to see his face, she recognized the silent monk who had let her into the complex earlier. From the looks of it, he'd been shot with a short burst from an automatic weapon. Kneeling down next to him, she checked for a pulse, but, as she'd expected, didn't find one. His eyes were open, staring at the sky above, and so she brushed her hand over them and then got back to her feet. Her car was still in the parking area, but the driver's window had been smashed, and the line of bullet holes stitched across the hood let her know that she wouldn't be taking it anywhere in the near future. Worse was the fact that they'd gotten the chest, and therefore the puzzle box that it contained. When she'd returned to the complex and rushed back into the monastery, she'd left the chest on the rear seat of the car. Easy pickings for anyone looking for it. There was nothing to do now but soldier on and see what she could make out of this mess. There were two more bodies on the front steps of the main building. Another was just inside the door. Each of them had been gunned down in similar fashion. Farther inside, she found more of the same. It appeared that the intruders, whoever they had been, had wanted to be certain there weren't any witnesses. She kept up her search for survivors all the way to the cathedral, but she didn't find a single one by the time she reached her destination. Inside, she found the abbot lying on the floor in front of the altar, a bullet hole through his skull. Four of the fingers on his left hand were broken and horribly twisted. Obviously, the gunman had tortured him for information. Whether he'd told them what they wanted to know or not was uncertain, for they could have executed him after he'd given up the information, or when they'd decided that they didn't have any more time to waste.
In the end, it doesn't really matter after all. They got what they came for anyway, thanks to my carelessness.
Standing there, looking down at the body of the man who only hours before had helped her uncover a key clue to the mystery, Anya felt a rage beginning to build inside her. She vowed that she'd bring the perpetrators to justice, no matter what. She searched the rest of the complex, but didn't find a single survivor. The monks living there had been slaughtered to a man. She did, however, find a phone on the abbot's desk. It was the only one she'd seen so far in the entire monastery, so she was thankful that the intruders hadn't torn it loose from the wall. She punched in 112, the general emergency number throughout all of France, and explained to the operator that there had been a violent attack on the monks at the monastery. She identified herself when asked and stated that they could contact the American embassy for confirmation of who she was, so that they would know this was not a crank call of any kind. Given the nearest town was almost an hour away, and she didn't remember seeing any kind of emergency response services when she'd driven through, Anya knew she had a long wait ahead of her. Now that she had taken care of the most pressing issues, she realized that she was shivering violently. Her clothing was still wet despite the long walk, and the chill mountain air hadn't helped any. But a search of the abbot's quarters turned up nothing but boxers, socks, and long brown robes. The same held true of the rest of the rooms she looked into at the other end of the hall. The idea of meeting the authorities dressed like Friar Tuck didn't appeal to her at all, but what choice did she have? She selected a robe that looked to be the closest fit, stripped out of her wet clothing, and used a towel from a nearby bathroom to dry herself as best she could. Resigning herself to the inevitable, she pulled the robe on over her head. To her surprise, the fabric was much softer than she'd expected, and warm as well. Only half an hour had gone by when the sound of a helicopter caught her attention. She glanced out the window, saw it approaching in the distance, and went out to meet it. The aircraft came in over the trees, nose forward, so Anya didn't get a good look at the aircraft until the pilot spun it around and lined up for landing. That's when the insignia, a stylized dragon in mid-flight, became visible on the black fuselage. Anya knew that logo. It belonged to Dragon Tech Security Services, one of the many companies owned by her sometime ally, sometime nemesis, Garin Braden. The helicopter landed on the grass beside the parking area. The door opened almost immediately, and a squad of armed gunmen disembarked, moving with the kind of crisp efficiency that marked them as former military personnel. They fanned out in a half circle, the assault rifles in their hands pointing beyond her at the windows of the monastery. Behind them came Garin Braden. She'd met Garin at the same time she'd acquired her sword, the one that had once belonged to Joan of Arc. Whatever power had been imparted to the sword at the moment of Joan's death had also affected Garin and his former mentor, Rue. Both of them had been Joan's failed protectors. Both of them had been there to witness Joan's execution. Both of them had subsequently discovered that they no longer aged as other men did, that unless they were killed by injury or violence, it seemed they would most likely live forever. Over the years, they'd gone from being squire and master to equal competitors to deadly enemies. Only the arrival of Anya and the reforming of the sword that had been broken had brought them grudgingly back together again. At first, Garin had been convinced that the sword controlled his destiny, that by possessing it, Anya could threaten his very existence. He'd schemed to take it from her on more than one occasion, but thus far without success. Lately, it seemed that his attempts toward that end had been put on hold, but she was still wary around him. Anya waited for him at the base of the front steps as he strode across the lawn. He was dressed beautifully, as always, in a suit that was tailored to show off his muscular frame. It was only as he drew closer that she remembered she was barefoot and naked beneath the monk's robe. She wanted to sink right into the stone beneath her feet.
Hello. I'm looking for... Anya, is that you?
What are you doing here, Garin? Did you get lost on your way home?
I must say, you look ravishing in mud brown, Anya. And the way it accents your curves...
Cut the crap. What are you doing here? What do you want?
Must I always want something?
Yes.
Well, you have me there.
Garin surveyed the scene behind her, taking in bodies just inside the open door. When he looked at her again, his expression had gone serious.
Any survivors?
I haven't checked the entire grounds, but inside, no.
He nodded, and then walked away a few steps and waved to one of his men, summoning him over. They had a brief conversation outside of Anya's earshot, and then the first man was joined by two others as they fanned out to search the grounds.
Come on, we've got to get you out of here.
I'm not going anywhere with you, Garin. The authorities will be here soon. Do you just expect me to leave all these bodies behind because you say so?
Yes, that's exactly what I expect. Every minute you stay puts you in more danger. We need to leave.
I told you I'm not leaving. I called this in. I have a responsibility to be here when the authorities arrive.
That's exactly what they are counting on. Do you think I came out here just to see you looking like a reject from the local Renaissance fair?
What's going on? What aren't you telling me, Garin?
For heaven's sake, woman, we don't have time for that.
You'll make time or I'm not going with you. Now out with it.
Rather than say anything more himself, Garin pulled a digital recorder out of his pocket and hit the play button.
The Creed woman apparently survived the fall from the roof. She needs to be eliminated before she speaks to the police. Get back up there and get rid of her before she becomes more of a nuisance.
How did you get that?
I'd be happy to explain everything, but right now I think it's better if we got out of here, don't you?
As Anya opened her mouth to answer, they turned to see a dark model Mercedes bounce through the iron gates less than 300 yards away and rush toward them. Even as they watched, the front passenger window rolled down and a man's head and shoulders appeared. In his hands was an automatic weapon.
Run!
Anya turned and ran for the helicopter.
Oh!
Only to fall flat on her face as the hem of her robe got tangled in her feet. The helicopter pilot saw what was going on and prepared to get his aircraft out of there. Anya glanced back to see the Mercedes change direction and head right for her. As she scrambled to her feet, a hand with a grip like steel grabbed her arm.
Come on!
Garin was half-carrying Anya along beside him as he ran for the chopper. This time, Anya hiked up the hem of the robe. Garin's security team had finally gotten into the act. They sent a hail of covering fire at the Mercedes as they raced forward to plant themselves between the enemy and their employer. The open door of the helicopter loomed ahead of them. Garin's longer stride put him out ahead of Anya by a few feet, so he reached the helicopter before she did. He jumped inside the open doorway and then turned to face her, ready to lend a hand. She was looking right at him. A bullet took him high on the right side of his chest, tossing him backward into the darkness inside the helicopter.
Garin!
Anya leaped inside the helicopter as bullets slammed into the metal fuselage around her. She barely had time to grab hold of a nearby seat before the pilot took them up, arcing away from the gunfire as quickly as he could.
Whoa!
Anya spent an anxious minute holding on for dear life as the pilot leveled out, and then she scrambled over to where Garin was lying against the opposite bulkhead. She ripped open his suit coat, desperately afraid of what she'd find. The black face of a bulletproof vest stared back at her.
Thank God!
Can't keep your hands off me, ma'am.
Anya glanced up to find Garin watching her with an amused look on his face. She backed up to give him some room.
You bastard! I thought you were shot.
I was. That's how I ended up on the floor, remember?
Garin pulled himself up into a nearby chair, then indicated Anya should put on one of the headsets hanging off the nearby bulkhead as he reached to do the same. She did as instructed.
Take us back to my Frankfurt home.
What about your men?
They'll be fine. They'll neutralize the threat and then disperse as necessary. Don't worry, they know what they're doing.